Today on Focus, we welcome back personal finance expert Kevin Wasby. He's ready to answer your questions in areas like getting ready for retirement, buying a home, or sending your children to college. And then there are questions about those short-term financial goals that can sometimes be harder to save for than those long-term commitments. What's the best way to muster the fiscal discipline to save for a new car or a vacation on top of your long-term financial saving? Perhaps you have your own tricks for making sure you put some money aside that you can share with us. And when is borrowing money the best strategy for an important purchase instead of saving it up? Whether you're a beginner in the world of finance or someone with experience who's trying to move up to the next level, Kevin Wasby will be answering your personal finance questions on this edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus begins right after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. It's the third Friday of the month, our day for your personal finance questions. And we welcome back Kevin Wasby to take your calls and emails. Kevin is a CFA, that's a Chartered Financial Analyst, and he's a lecturer with the University of Illinois College of Business, just getting off the semesters. Did you have papers to grade? I don't know how being, what is a lecturer just like any other professor in terms of the workload?
Great question. In terms of the class load, perhaps a little bit more, but I'm done with grading. Grades are submitted. Today is the deadline for everyone, so I beat the deadline, and that's what I wanted to do.
And so all those students are ready to, well, I guess once they graduate, the ones that are graduating anyway, ready to enter into the world of finance.
Some of them did graduate a week ago this coming weekend, so we had fun with commencement exercises, and another year is behind us.
Well, Kevin Wasby is here this morning on Focus to answer your questions about investing, saving, and borrowing. We will also check in on Kevin's own low-maintenance couch potato portfolio later in the show. Right now, you can call us at 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu and also catch up with us on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us either way at Focus580. And actually, we have an emailed question that's come in from Jan, and she writes, "I'm a baby boomer, recently divorced with no savings. I worked 30 years paying in the Social Security. I started working full-time for the state of Illinois 3 years ago, so I am paying into CSRS now. He also has a part-time job as an independent contractor where I have to pay all of my own taxes. I feel like at this age it's hopeless to try to even start a savings account when I'm already barely able to make ends meet with 1.5 jobs. The future seems really bleak in light of the increase in taxes by the Obama administration and the Health Care Act. I'll be making less next year than I'm even making now. How can I possibly start saving?"
Excellent question. Don't know where to begin, but let me try the obvious. There's no way to make an income larger than either more work that pays a higher rate. Given that, for a person that has an income, and, you know, it sounds like we've got a question here where we have 1.5 jobs, I guess it comes down to the basic belief, and that is pay yourself first. There are expenses that have to be met. So the cost of housing, whether it's rent or mortgage, the cost of everything that you would consider to be essentials for anybody, and particularly for a person that asks this question, I would say you clearly need to define wants and needs. You clearly have to define wants and needs. I might want to be driving a new car, but I can tell you personally that I drive a 14-year-old $2,400 Chevy Blazer. That's me. I might want to eat out more frequently at nice restaurants, but, you know, even when it's on sale, I can buy food at the grocery store a whole lot cheaper. These are the kind of decisions that get into the mentality of pay yourself first. The persons mentioned, they're now employed by the state, so they're covered under CSRS. Under the present arrangement, that means, in essence, 8% of their wage is taken out with no choice and put into a retirement plan for them. That's a start. As a state employee, they also have the ability to defer some of their savings into either a 403B or 457 plan. Those are pre-tax salary savings plans that allow a person to voluntarily take money out of their paycheck, keep it from being taxable income in the year in which it's earned, and put it away for their retirement. I would advocate anyone that has an opportunity to take money out of their paycheck and put it into such plan, do so. And put more in than you think you can afford. There, the bailout, the escape hatch is you can always change that allocation, that deduction amount to a lesser amount. And I would say save until it hurts.
So you're talking about taking out how much of out of your income?
How much is the $64,000 question? You could answer it as a percentage of a wage. You could answer it as a dollar amount. It really doesn't make any difference because each person is going to be different. Each person needs to start out with defining wants and needs. If we can define what monthly needs are legitimately and then say everything else is a want, we'll then get to some amount per month in terms of dollars and cents that might be eligible or able to be deferred.
Okay. And, of course, that's going to be different within every person's case. So it's something where you really have to sit down and look at and look at your own spending patterns and figure out where the essentials are.
Exactly. A person's income is half of the equation. The other important half, and maybe even more important, is, again, what's the difference between a want and a need? You can't skip rent payments. You can't skip mortgage payments. But you can allocate those decisions that are consumption or postpone consumption. What you'd like to say is the, how should we say, economists speak for savings.
Okay. You know, some of the choices being made here make me think of another question that myself and my producer, Lindsay Moon, were kicking around the last few days, and that's how to take on a short-term savings goal. And it may be one thing to have committed to a long-term savings goal, something you're doing for years or decades, and you know that that money is being set aside. But now you want to set aside something additional for something short-term, like, say, for instance, buying a new car or saving for a vacation or any cost like that, which may be, I guess, a few thousand dollars. That it may not be an end-of-the-world thing. On the other hand, it may be important, and it's something you want to do relatively quickly. But it can be a challenge to tell yourself to take that money out. Are there any techniques or just judgment enablers that you found that work in that area?
I think the biggest commonality is the mind games that we each play on ourselves. So let's say I'm a person that, you know, habitually stops and gets themselves a nice $3.50 coffee on the way to work every morning. And if I thought about that $3.50 every day on the way to work, you know, what could I do to save the same? Could I give up the coffee? Could I get a cup of coffee at home that's a whole lot cheaper than $3.50 at my favorite coffee bar? However, it comes down to tricking yourself into saying, you know, I'm going to put this same amount of money away. If it's a substitute, I'll quit getting the $3.50 cup of coffee, fine. If it's a matching, can I find $3.50 in my wallet every day that I get that $3.50 cup of coffee and match it by putting it into savings? And again, the easiest way to match it or put it into savings or substitute it is to have your employer take it out of your paycheck before it ever hits disposable income or take-home pay.
Okay. Well, and if perhaps you have your own ideas on how to on how to put that little extra piece of money away for a short-term goal, give us a call or an email here on Focus, where we're talking about personal finance with personal finance expert Kevin Wasby. Our number, 333-9455, or call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. And we have a caller coming in, well, in just a moment, but I'm going to go to an email right now from Terry in Barefoot Bay, Florida. So I assume Terry's listening to us online at will.illinois.edu. Terry writes, I have come to realize lately just how significant the fees are that are charged by investment companies, including plans for 401k accounts. This is quite disturbing given how many difficulties folks are having preparing for retirement. It is clear that index funds provide the lowest cost way for people to invest. Some companies, such as Vanguard, are superiors in terms of the low fees. Recently, my wife inherited some mutual funds. Would you believe that a front-end load of 5.5% had been paid by the deceased to make this investment? My question is this: how much longer are we going to allow people to be snookered by investment companies and in 401k plans? That's what Terry wants to know.
Well, that's a good question, and it does bring up what I would say basic consumer awareness. When you shop for anything, you should shop for value. Value is more than price. Value has to do with what you get for what you're paying. But let's look at it this way. First, separation. Load versus no-load funds. A load is a commission. The commission was paid to a commission salesperson, presumably because that person added value in a sense of making some recommendation. Now, the 5.5% front load paid by the person's spouse, deceased father or mother, may have been a part of a relationship that made that payment well worth it. For a person that doesn't want or doesn't need that kind of relationship, a no-load mutual fund means that a person purchases it from the company directly and then pays no commission to any employee or the company itself. That's the first layer. The second layer of looking for value is looking for those charges made by the fund company each year as really a deduction of a rate of return. So the overhead expenses, what Morningstar or any other mutual fund rating company would look at and call us the expense ratio. Vanguard was the company's name that the listener mentioned. Vanguard is probably the most well-known mutual fund company that has some of the lowest expense ratio funds you'll find. And what's low? A low expense ratio can be anything from, say, 3 or 4 basis points to as high as maybe 25 to 30 basis points. And a basis point is 1/100th of 1%. So quick example. If the portfolio earns a 5% rate of return in a given year and the expense ratio is 30 basis points, the shareholder in that fund is going to get the 5 less 0.3 or 4.7% rate of return. Obviously, if you talk about a fund that has a 5 basis point rate of expense ratio, that same 5% rate of return is going to net the shareholder of the mutual fund 4.95%. So you want to shop for low expense, no load mutual funds.
So you're shopping around for that, and also in terms of if you're working with a salesman or a broker to deciding how much you need their expertise.
Exactly.
And I believe we have a caller waiting. I'm going to go to line one, and Ken in Urbana, good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for discussing this topic. I was hoping you could just talk a little bit about difference between the pre-tax and post-tax savings accounts for retirement. And my understanding was always that when you're younger, and I'm in my early 30s, so I think I'm still qualified as younger, but when you're younger, you should do post-tax because you're likely to be in a much higher tax bracket when you're in retirement compared to what you are when you're younger. But I just would like any sort of advice about what an appropriate type of retirement account would be good. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. Another layer in the onion that we could peel back. Once a person's decided that they're going to put money away for future use, retirement use, let's call it, something that literally is the next step decision is to think about what you've brought up. I could put the money into my employer's 403B plan, and the employer gives me the choice, or 401K plan in the private sector. I could put my money in there as a pre-tax contribution, pay no income tax on it now, but at a point in the future when I withdraw the money, pay income tax at whatever rate I'm in then. If you think your career is in such a position so that you've not come close to maximizing your income and therefore probably not come close to maximizing your tax burden, then you may consider, at the moment you're paying taxes at a lower rate, go ahead and put it into a Roth contribution. The Roth, a subdivision of that retirement plan allows the person to put the money in, but it's not a current year tax deduction. The earnings, the growth, the buildup, whatever you want to call it, is sheltered from taxes. And when the money comes out of a Roth type of retirement plan, the money itself is not a taxable distribution. So you pay no income tax on it, which makes sense because the money itself, the principal, if you want to call it that, that you put in was after-tax money. You've already paid taxes on it. One of the nice things about a Roth is the money that you've never paid income tax on, the growth, the buildup, the earnings, whatever you want to call it, also comes out tax-free. So that's an excellent second-step decision. If I'm going to put money away for the long haul, let's call it retirement, if I'm going to look at not breaking this money out of there until at least I'm 60, 65 years old, then that consideration as to where you are in your income, life cycle, and what tax rate you're at, might very well find an advantage to seeding money into an after-tax type of retirement account, the Roth component.
Okay. I hope that answers your question,
yeah.
Ken.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have an email coming in from Mike. Kevin, you could explain what the program, I'm pronouncing this correctly, Kasasa Cash is. That's K-A-S-A-S-A. Mike saw this referenced in a Consumer Reports article talking about high-yield checking options. Have you heard of Kasasa Cash?
Not that particular acronym, but the subject broadly, yes.
And I'm looking at, actually, I did a quick Google and found several banks offering them, one of them describing it as an interest-bearing free checking account that puts 3.01 APY available. I think another bank put it maybe a percentage point higher than that. So what's the principle of these sort of things?
Well, Jim, if you do a little bit deeper looking on that web page that you have up, what you might want to do is see if there is a strict disclaimer. The disclaimer would say something to the effect of funds are not guaranteed by FDIC, that they are subject to risk of loss, so on and so on and so forth.
In very tiny type, you know?
In very tiny type.
I'm going to have to take my glasses off for this, and let's see. APY paid at the portion of the balances above $15,000 each cycle. The qualifications are met. Up to $10 ATM fee refunds nationwide. If you do not meet the qualifications per cycle, your account will still function as a free checking account earning 0.10% APY, but it will not get ATM fee refunds. And I should say that free ATM use is I guess, a big part of the draw. Rates are subject to change. Accounts available in a named list of counties. Minimum to open, $100. No minimum balance required. No monthly service charge. Available to personal accounts only. Is that the sort of language you would expect to see?
Somewhere in one of those disclaimers would be how or why the account is earning such a high rate of return. Let me just give you a proxy. If I thought about something being free of default risk and perhaps even free of, loss of value risk, let me just give you some proxies for rates of return on U.S. Treasuries right now. If I looked at the yield on a six-month Treasury bill right now, it would be approximately 18 basis points. That's 0.18%. How am I getting 3% on overnight money, a checking account? The answer is with most of these accounts, the interest rate is tied to an index of earnings on bank loans. The money is actually not an FDIC-insured deposit, but literally is a participation in a pool of loans. Those loans usually have floating rates of interest, so if interest rates go up, theoretically, the yield on that account goes up. But the bottom line is that it is not a bank deposit product like we would think about a normal savings account, checking account, or certificate of deposit. It is something tied to what I would say is a market value asset that has risk not only of value but risk of default.
What are good circumstances for using a product like this?
Well, it's like anything else. Risk and return are positively correlated. So if you think you can assume more risk with those monies and you want to try to get that return, then that's fine. The same question would be asked, well, why would I put my money in a stock? Well, I put my money in a stock because I hope to get a rate of return higher than I get in some type of savings vehicle like a certificate of deposit. The risk is obviously whatever I pay for the stock can be something totally different a year away from today, whatever. And obviously any kind of income potential from it, whether it's a dividend paid on the stock or the interest paid on a certificate of deposit, is again comparing apples and oranges. So risk and return, very positive correlation. The higher the return, the reason is there is a higher risk.
Okay. And so these are, I guess the generic name is something like a rewards checking account. And Kasasa is a brand of one of those checking accounts. In reading further about it, I gather Kasasa is a brand that small banks can make use of, something that gives them a program that compete with maybe similar programs offered by very large banks. One that I see here is the Smart Sense program offered by Capital One, for instance. So whether it has one name or another, they're all rewards checking accounts, and they all come with certain caveats, I take it.
Well, again, if this is an FDIC-insured product, I really haven't dug into the particular website or bank that you're looking at. But I've got to believe that there's something wrong with this picture when I see three percentage points claimed as an annual percentage yield on a bank-insured product that gives access to the money literally any time by writing a check.
Okay. That's something to be interested in. I'm looking at I'm looking at some of the comments. This is on a page called Credit Karma. So this particular page is essentially a review of Kasasa. So I don't know if it has the same sort of details as the bank web pages. Again, it sounds like however you come across it, just make sure you read all the fine print, because it is a financial product like any other, so it has its ups and downs. We're going to take a break right now and come back with more of your financial questions for Kevin Wasby here on Focus on WYLL. And we're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. Lindsay Moon is my producer, and Jason Croft is my technical director, taking your phone calls on personal finance questions for personal finance expert Kevin Wasby. He's a CFA and a lecturer at the U of I College of Business and you can talk to him at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, or call toll-free at 1-800-222-WILL. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Still trying to find out more about these rewards checking accounts like Casasa. But I was just wondering, on a more general sense, you handed me some financial headlines, and they seem to match some other things that I was looking at. I was looking at a copy of The Week magazine. And either way, markets are up. And the headline I'm reading is the Dow and the S&P hit new highs. Apparently, U.S. consumers' view of the economy also turned much brighter in the first part of this month, according to a sentiment index from Thomson Reuters and the University of Michigan. Everything is looking bright. What do you do with information like that? One thing I've always wondered with the stock market, for instance, if the stock market is going up, does that mean if you're someone who might be investing, that it's time to get in? Or should you have gotten in earlier and now it's perhaps a little late since values are already high? Or are they going to get even higher and it might be worth it?
Yeah, the market has certainly been on a tear. We've seen the kinds of returns year to date that would make an entire 12 months look very robust. So as an example, in David Sinnoh's couch portfolio, group of eight different Vanguard index funds, there is across the board a double-digit year-to-date return. I mean, we're really looking at less than a half a year, with 16, 18, 17, 17, 19, 18 percent rates of return in these funds. And, you know, your question about is it too late? Boy, if I could answer that, I probably wouldn't be here. Or we'd be doing this interview with me calling in from some luscious beach. But let's put it this way. For people to be more confident, to see the kinds of reports that we've seen this morning, whether it's the leading economic indicators or the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey perking up, these are all of the things that we're hoping to see with what's been going on for the past 5 years in trying to stimulate the economy to move forward.
Is this the light at the end of the tunnel?
As long as it's not an oncoming train, the answer could still be yes.
Okay. And if it is the light at the end of the tunnel, what does that mean as far as an investor is concerned?
Well, the hopes have been, again, over the past 5 years, that pushing money into the economy, whether it's the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, doing that in this country, or as most central banks are doing in their own countries, pushing money into the economy would hopefully then allow business and individuals to begin making investments, to begin making more, hiring decisions, and begin creating more wealth and income for all the participants in the economy. That's the theory. But we have a very, very contrived market. It is a market where our central banks and banks in general have become the market participants. I'm very leery of seeing this kind of results or this kind of confidence when what's been going on for the past 5 years has been a grand experiment.
Okay, so what could go wrong, I guess, is the question here.
Well, why are interest rates near zero, aside from the Casasa mystery still unanswered?
I mean, interest rates should be going up with everything else.
Well, why are interest rates near zero? I mean, I don't know where they should be going, but why are they near zero? The answer to that I know. The known is the fact that interest rates have been pushed to artificially low rates in this attempt to stimulate the economy. When you look at some of the statistics of where central banks are now in the ownership of things like bonds, so the outstanding debt of countries and corporations, There's never been a time where central banks have owned more of these bonds. When they buy these bonds, they push their prices up, which pushes yields down, which basically then sets the tone for interest rates on everything else. The bottom line is there an end to when central banks quit buying bonds? And I would have to say at some point we could imagine there will be an end to that. The big question then becomes what happens with interest rates when an artificial demand is no longer there?
Will there be a real demand coming to take its place?
Well, will it be like a rubber band? I mean, we've stretched the rubber band to the point where we've got a single large gorilla, the central banks of the world, basically being the marketplace of bonds. When that gorilla retires, assuming that they do retire, that is going to leave the market in a place where we've not seen this before. We've not seen this type of universal concerted effort happening to this extent. So that's the grand experiment part.
Well, we have some more questions coming in. We have an email about home investment. But first, I want to go to the phones and to line one for Ernest in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. What's the chance that it's simply a matter of protecting the income of the very wealthy, like had been done with any number of small banks, all of which are merged now into a bunch of big ones, none of which are responsible? And the matter of low interest seems to be only giving money manipulators the opportunity to speculate in pre-purchase of stuff, creating an unreal demand.
Well, and that's, you know, that's a, how should we say, a possible interpretation.
It seems like we're feeding inflation to pay for our war debts.
Well, I don't know if we're feeding inflation so much. I mean, I'll give you three different scenarios. This is not my original work, but back in the spring of 2011, in an NBER working paper, Carmen Reinhart, one of the Reinhart-Rogoff team that's recently been discredited because of some data snafus, wrote a nice working paper. She literally looked back over history and saw times when debt levels got to the point of being onerous, how economies worked their way out of it. And the two obvious ways come to most people's minds. The first is inflation, and the second is default. She proposed a third and showed evidence that it was actually used right after World War II quite effectively. She terms this financial repression, and it's literally where everyone pays without really knowing it. So why is a person that has some amount of savings getting 15 basis points on their one-year CD right now? Well, they're paying to bail out the excesses. Excesses across the board. So, you know, stupid banks making stupid loan decisions, stupid borrowers making stupid borrowing decisions, stupid businesses making stupid investment decisions.
Or is it good banks leading people on to making bad investments and then breaking them?
Well, I've never seen a bank.
Oh, I have.
I've never seen a bank deal drugs.
It just depends where you're looking. Real estate is the more usual place.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
It's kind of like our habit of forcing the price of agricultural commodities down to the point where they're no longer effectively grown by small farms out of the country, and then shipping our grain there, making a good profit at it, and then suddenly finding that indeed through devaluation or whatever, the grain becomes horribly expensive here, has driven thousands of farmers out of business here and abroad, and has a few companies doing pretty decently.
Well, again, we can see, you know, there are all kinds of scenarios that we could paint
Works that way sometimes, doesn't it?
Well, sure.
Let's keep this on the grounds of personal finance, and if we're going to talk about these sort of economic theories, Ernest, thank you very much for your call. I'm just wondering if this is the sort of situation that existed, or if the model that you mentioned, Kevin, was in fact the case. What's an individual investor to do if we're in a situation where essentially maybe interest rates are low and then the benefits for investors are low, and that's sort of a penalty for bad financial decisions made for others? What's the best thing to do in that situation?
Well, I think the best thing to do is to make your decisions based on your own needs and your own budget and basically live with the environment. The environment will change. If you want to feel like you're getting, punished for somebody else's bad decisions, feel that way all you wish. But my God, don't shoot yourself in the foot and go out and do something silly. Silly would be chasing yield, trying to find a higher rate of return, but realizing at some point in the future that the risk was something that you couldn't stomach. I can be angry about what's going on right now, but it's really kind of silly to end up, you know, hurting myself in the long run by doing something that I'm being, reactive to.
Okay.
I think sound budgeting decisions are going to hold regardless of the environment. I think sound saving and investment decisions are going to hold regardless of, whether it's financial repression or screwing the small farmer through manipulating commodity prices or whatever else you want to imagine as a scenario.
Well, let me go to the email question from Jeff on home investment, and this also is something which takes low interest rates into consideration. Jeff writes, "My wife and I are planning on selling our current home for a smaller house in a few years, but I'd like to take advantage of the low interest rates and relatively low house prices. I'm guessing in 5 years, they will both be significantly higher. My idea would be to start looking for the future house now, and if we find what we like, purchase it now and then rent it out until we're ready to sell our current home. We have cash savings we could use for down payment and other expenses. As long as we could cash flow the mortgage, insurance, real estate taxes, and repairs with the rent revenue. I'm viewing this as an investment for right now, but the question for you, Kevin, is are there any red flags you can see in this idea?"
I won't call it red flags, but I'd say considerations not mentioned.
By consideration, you mean?
Well, conditions have I thought of, have I planned for? So let me give a for instance. Basically, the description of strategy here, I would call an arbitrage. You're trying to arbitrage buying a house at a very low interest rate right now, but not actually selling the other one until you think you can get a higher price for it. That's arbitraging market prices and market interest rates. If you believe that interest rates were going to go higher, at some point you'd have to also believe that the higher cost of borrowing money to buy a house might also have a depressing effect on the value of the house. So I would caution somebody just thinking through without including that potential. Again, not selling the existing house right now, if it's because you think that the price will go higher, well, that may not be the case necessarily if interest rates are going to go higher, which again takes you back to the why you'd borrow money now to buy a second house. Let's go back, forget about arbitrage for a minute, but just say that we've considered it. The other thing to think about is income security. Given that you're assuming to cover all costs on a second house by being able to rent it, how stable is the rental market in the area that you live and consider doing this? Market rents have been, artificially high over the past 5 years. Not because housing prices have continued to go up as they were in 2004, 2005, 2006. Housing prices haven't. They've gone down. The reason rental income has been artificially high, and this is nationally, not every literally city block, but nationally, is because so many people have not been able to qualify for a mortgage loan to buy a house. That puts them forcibly into the rental market. So you've got a lot of rent demand in the current environment. If the credit situation and the income of individuals stabilizes and begins to rise, then I would also include in my analysis a little consideration to the fact that rental incomes might come under pressure if more people are able to move out of the rental market and into the home purchase market. So that's the first, threat to the income from rental.
Is that the rental market could change.
Yeah, the rental market will change like most markets change.
Okay, so
the third thing I would consider is the person's employment situation. So again, we've got risk to the rental income on the second property. There's also risk to the income of the person from their position of employment. How secure are they? Have they made any plans for any kind of contingencies in income? I'll give you a simple one. What happens if you become disabled?
Okay, disabled and you're not able to work, that you don't have income coming in.
Well, have you planned for that?
Mm-hmm.
Some people do, some people don't.
What are the basic building blocks of a plan?
I think the basic building blocks are a lot like the basic building blocks of budgeting. You have to look at those things that are within your control, make the decisions that give you comfort in achieving your objectives, and have some amount of contingency planning for things out of your control.
Interesting thing about financial planning is you always have to look at the gloomy side, it seems, about the things that could go wrong so you can guard against them.
You don't have to. You could go into any planning scenario and imagine that everything works perfectly.
And then see what happens.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that is one way to do it. We still have time for your questions about personal finance with Kevin Waspy. Give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number is again 333-WILL, toll free at 800-222-WILL. We were talking a little bit earlier about how to give yourself the fiscal discipline to save for a short-term goals. What are the times? What are the circumstances when borrowing is the right way to go instead of just saving up? I mean, imagine if you don't have the money and it's something that's considered absolutely essential, but what factors do you have to have in place to make that work?
Well, I think borrowing makes sense in many circumstances. As long as the money that we're borrowing is not going to be a burden. And again, that burden needs to meet the test of contingencies. So it may not be a burden based on your present income, but how secure is your income? The second consideration is this. What is the money being borrowed for? If we're borrowing money to buy a disposable, depreciating asset, something like a car, to me that does not make sense.
It's better if you can to pay cash for a car.
Well, you know,
if you can.
I'm cheap.
Yes.
Okay? So in my opinion, yeah, it's better to drive less of a car that you've paid for.
Although I guess someone might think is, I don't have the cash now. I need the money to work. I need the car to work. Therefore, the car is an avenue towards earning income. I'll have to borrow the money to get the car.
Absolutely. I mean, there are times where your optimal solution is not going to be debt-free. But again, a consideration to borrowing money to buy a disposable asset, if it fits the picture of producing income, then it's a necessary condition.
And I suppose, although I don't know how often it works that way, that if you have assets which are earning interest, and that they're earning more than perhaps you would be paying in interest on the loan. Would that be something to consider?
Well, again, we're going to call that an arbitrage, and few are the times, few are the instances where if I equate the risks on each the loan and on the investment, am I going to find an opportunity to arbitrage a cost of money cheaper than my rate of return? You see, that's what banks do. That's the business of a bank. Now, if I get a charter and become a bank, that would be my business.
So you would have to be really good at it to make it work for you.
As an individual, I think you'd have to be very lucky to be able to do it consistently.
Okay. We have calls lining up, and I want to say hello to line one, Ken in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
I know it's coming one of these days. What about inflation? I know it's not calculated, truly from the standpoint of that, we have these inflated, but, in terms of our statistics, the national one, so how far off are we?
I remember the 1970s, Kevin. There used to be a lot of inflation.
Absolutely. The 1970s were a very, ugly time. I'd even take you back to the 1960s and see some of the seeds of that. Do I see that type of potential for inflation in our near term? Not really. The demographics of how we got to where we got back then are very different than the present. I do see that as a potential at some point, maybe 10 years out. And then let's talk about inflation versus measured inflation. When I drove to the station, I looked at the gas station and they'd posted $3.87 a gallon gasoline. When I look at the government statistics and I say that inflation, producer prices, consumer prices, whichever metric reported this week, showed a decline over the past month, predominantly because of a 7.5% decline in the price of gasoline, then I say hooey. Because, you know what, I didn't see a 7% decline in the cost of gasoline, and I doubt many people did. So the point of inflation is twofold. We can all look at the government-reported statistics, and those are used to adjust different types of, indexed payments. We could also look at it from a personal point of view, and I think we've all experienced a higher level or rate of inflation over the past 3 to 5 years than any government statistic series would show.
So that there is inflation out there more than has been measured. Have some things, though, perhaps in what we buy been staying flat or even going down?
Well, sure. If you want to measure the cost of your last HD TV that you bought, if you want to measure the cost of your last iPhone, I mean, gadgets, consumer electronics. I mean, this is an industry that is built on the fact that prices always decline. That's why they come out with new models so that they can sell you the latest, greatest piece at the premium price.
But okay, so quickly, I have, inflation-linked bonds, So the question is that they were doing okay there for a while, but is that a bad investment or something that maybe I should or just hold on to?
Well, I wouldn't sell them now, but I wouldn't be a buyer of them now. When you look at TIPS, they're really producing a negative rate of return right now. And you've brought up an illustration of the conundrum because you see the kicker for the inflation component in TIPS is the government measured index of inflation,
right,
which has been a heck of a lot less than what you or I or most people would say has been in your experienced inflation.
And the bonds have taken a hit too,
Absolutely. Would I be a buyer now? No. Would I be a seller of them right now? I don't think so.
You think they're going to be useful later on?
I think you're going to have an opportunity to see the use come on more efficiently in the coming 5 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Appreciate the show.
Okay, Ken, thank you very much. We have just about a minute left, and I'm going to use it to talk to line four, Bill in Aurora. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes, I. Where on the website is the couch potato? Where's that located on here yet?
We don't have it on yet. I think we're having a few formatting issues getting it on, but we're going to get it on later today. And I'll tell you what, if you email us at will-talk will-talk@illinois.edu and ask for the portfolio. We can see about getting it out to you. So go ahead and use that email address, will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'll also try to get a link to it up on our website later today at will.illinois.edu/focus.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we're just about out of time now for this monthly show on personal finance here on Focus. And thanks to you, Kevin Wasby, for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's always good to be here and always nice to be able to talk with the callers.
Okay. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Kimberly Cronick and Pam Dempsey are also part of the Focus team. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. Coming up on Monday, women's health issues. Was Angelina Jolie's decision to undergo a preventive double mastectomy appropriate? What were her circumstances, and what are the other options? That's just one question that might be posed for Dr. Suzanne Truppen on Monday when she returns to Focus for another program devoted to women's health. Kimberly Cronick will be your host on Monday's edition of Focus. Remember, Focus airs live every weekday morning at 10. That's when we can take your calls and questions live. There's a replay at 8 p.m., and you can hear us around the world at your convenience at will.illinois.edu. And for our free downloadable podcast, sign up at will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.